The Kreutzer Sonata and Other Stories. The Kreutzer Sonata, Chapter 1. Travelers left and entered our car at every stopping of the train. Three persons, however, remained, bound, like myself, for the farthest station, a lady neither young nor pretty, smoking cigarettes, with a thin face, a cap on her head, and wearing a semi-masculine outer garment, then her companion, a very loquacious gentleman of about 40 years, with baggage entirely new and arranged in an orderly manner, then a gentleman who held himself entirely aloof, short in stature, very nervous, of uncertain age, with bright eyes, not pronounced in color, but extremely attractive, eyes that darted with rapidity from one object to another. This gentleman, during almost all the journey thus far, had entered into conversation with no fellow traveler, as if he carefully avoided all acquaintance. When spoken to, he answered curtly and decisively, and began to look out of the car window obstinately. Yet it seemed to me that the solitude weighed upon him. He seemed to perceive that I understood this, and when our eyes met, as happened frequently, since we were sitting almost opposite each other, he turned away his head, and avoided conversation with me as much as with the others. At nightfall, during a stop at a large station, the gentleman with the fine baggage alloyer, as I have since learned, got out with his companion to drink some tea at the restaurant. During their absence, several new travelers entered the car, among whom was a tall old man, shaven and wrinkled, evidently a merchant, wearing a large heavily lined cloak and a big cap. This merchant sat down opposite the empty seats of the lawyer and his companion, and straightway entered into conversation with a young man who seemed like an employee in some commercial house, and who had likewise just boarded the train. At first the clerk had remarked that the seat opposite was occupied, and the old man had answered that he should get out at the first station. Thus their conversation started. I was sitting not far from these two travelers, and, as the train was not in motion, I could catch bits of their conversation when others were not talking. They talked first of the prices of goods and the condition of business, they referred to a person whom they both knew, then they plunged into the fair at Nizhny Novgorod. The clerk boasted of knowing people who were leading a gay life there, but the old man did not allow him to continue, and, interrupting him, began to describe the festivities of the previous year at Kanovino, in which he had taken part. He was evidently proud of these recollections, and, probably thinking that this would detract nothing from the gravity which his face and manners expressed, he related with pride how, when drunk, he had fired, at Kanovino, such a broadside that he could describe it only in the other's ear. The clerk began to laugh noisily. The old man laughed too, showing two long yellow teeth. Their conversation not interesting me, I left the car to stretch my legs. At the door I met the lawyer and his lady. "You have no more time," the lawyer said to me. "The second bell is about to ring." Indeed, I had scarcely reached the rear of the train when the bell sounded. As I entered the car again, the lawyer was talking with his companion in an animated fashion. The merchant, sitting opposite them, was taciturn. "And then she squarely declared to her husband," said the lawyer with a smile, as I passed by them, "that she neither could nor would live with him, because—" And he continued, but I did not hear the rest of the sentence, my attention being distracted by the passing of the conductor and a new traveler. When silence was restored, I again heard the lawyer's voice. The conversation had passed from a special case to general considerations. "And afterward comes discord, financial difficulties, disputes between the two parties, and the couple separate. In the good old days that seldom happened. Is it not so?" asked the lawyer of the two merchants, evidently trying to drag them into the conversation. Just then the train started, and the old man, without answering, took off his cap, and crossed himself three times while muttering a prayer. When he had finished, he clapped his cap far down on his head, and said, "Yes, sir, that happened in former times also, but not as often. In the present day it is bound to happen more frequently. People have become too learned." The lawyer made some reply to the old man, but the train, ever increasing its speed, made such a clatter upon the rails that I could no longer hear distinctly. As I was interested in what the old man was saying, I drew nearer. My neighbor, the nervous gentleman, was evidently interested also, and, without changing his seat, he lent an ear. "But what harm is there in education?" asked the lady, with a smile that was scarcely perceptible. "Would it be better to marry as in the old days, when the bride and bridegroom did not even see each other before marriage?" she continued, answering, as is the habit of our ladies, not the words that her interlocutor had spoken, but the words she believed he was going to speak. "Women did not know whether they would love or would be loved, and they were married to the first comer, and suffered all their lives. Then you think it was better so? She continued, evidently addressing the lawyer and myself, and not at all the old man. People have become too learned, repeated the last, looking at the lady with contempt, and leaving her question unanswered. I should be curious to know how you explain the correlation between education and conjugal differences, said the lawyer, with a slight smile. The merchant wanted to make some reply, but the lady interrupted him. No, those days are past. The lawyer cut short her words, dash. Let him express his thought. Because there is no more fear, replied the old man. But how will you marry people who do not love each other? Only animals can be coupled at the will of a proprietor. But people have inclinations, attachments, the lady hastened to say, casting a glance at the lawyer, at me, and even at the clerk, who, standing up and leaning his elbow on the back of a seat, was listening to the conversation with a smile. You are wrong to say that, madam, said the old man. The animals are beasts, but man has received the law. But, nevertheless, how is one to live with a man when there is no love? Said the lady, evidently excited by the general sympathy and attention. Formerly no such distinctions were made, said the old man, gravely. Only now have they become a part of our habits. As soon as the least thing happens, the wife says, I release you. I am going to leave your house. Even among the moochicks this fashion has become acclimated. There, she says, here are your shirts and drawers. I am going off with Vanka. His hair is curlier than yours. Just go talk with them. And yet the first rule for the wife should be fear. The clerk looked at the lawyer, the lady, and myself, evidently repressing a smile, and all ready to deride or approve the merchant's words, according to the attitude of the others. What fear? Said the lady. This fear, the wife must fear her husband, that is what fear. Oh, that, my little father, that is ended. No, madam, that cannot end. As she, Eve, the woman, was taken from man's ribs, so she will remain unto the end of the world, said the old man, shaking his head so triumphantly and so severely that the clerk, deciding that the victory was on his side, burst into a loud laugh. Yes, you men think so, replied the lady, without surrendering, and turning toward us. You have given yourself liberty. As for woman, you wish to keep her in the seraglio. To you, everything is permissible. Is it not so? Oh, man, that's another affair. Then, according to you, to man everything is permissible? No one gives him this permission, only, if the man behaves badly outside, the family is not increased thereby, but the woman, the wife, is a fragile vessel, continued the merchant, severely. His tone of authority evidently subjugated his hearers. Even the lady felt crushed, but she did not surrender. Yes, but you will admit, I think, that woman is a human being, and has feelings like her husband. What should she do if she does not love her husband? If she does not love him, repeated the old man, stormily, and knitting his brows, why, she will be made to love him. This unexpected argument pleased the clerk, and he uttered a murmur of approbation. Oh, no, she will not be forced, said the lady. Where there is no love, one cannot be obliged to love in spite of herself. And if the wife deceives her husband, what is to be done? Said the lawyer. That should not happen, said the old man. He must have his eyes about him. And if it does happen, all the same? You will admit that it does happen? It happens among the upper classes, not among us, answered the old man. And if any husband is found who is such a fool as not to rule his wife, he will not have robbed her. But no scandal, nevertheless. Love or not, but do not disturb the household. Every husband can govern his wife. He has the necessary power. It is only the imbecile who does not succeed in doing so. Everybody was silent. The clerk moved, advanced, and, not wishing to lag behind the others in the conversation, began with his eternal smile. Yes, in the house of our employer, a scandal has arisen, and it is very difficult to view the matter clearly. The wife loved to amuse herself, and began to go astray. He is a capable and serious man. First, it was with the bookkeeper. The husband tried to bring her back to reason through kindness. She did not change her conduct. She plunged into all sorts of beastliness. She began to steal his money. He beat her, but she grew worse and worse. To an unbaptized, to a pagan, to a Jew, saving your permission, she went in succession for her caresses. What could the employer do? He has dropped her entirely, and now he lives as a bachelor. As for her, She is dragging in the depths. He is an imbecile, said the old man. If from the first he had not allowed her to go in her own fashion, and had kept a firm hand upon her, she would be living honestly, no danger. Liberty must be taken away from the beginning. Do not trust yourself to your horse upon the highway. Do not trust yourself to your wife at home. At that moment the conductor passed, asking for the tickets for the next station. The old man gave up his. Yes, the feminine sex must be dominated in season, else all will perish. And you yourselves, at Countavino, did you not lead a gay life with the pretty girls? Asked the lawyer with a smile. Oh, that's another matter, said the merchant, severely. Goodbye, he added, rising. He wrapped himself in his cloak, lifted his cap, and, taking his bag, left the car. Chapter 2. Scarcely had the old man gone when a general conversation began. There's a little Old Testament father for you, said the clerk. He's a domostroy, said the lady. What savage ideas about a woman and marriage. The domostroy is a matrimonial code of the days of Ivan the Terrible. Yes, gentlemen, said the lawyer, we are still a long way from the European ideas upon marriage. First, the rights of woman, then free marriage, then divorce, as a question not yet solved. The main thing, and the thing which such people as he do not understand, rejoined the lady, is that only love consecrates marriage, and that the real marriage is that which is consecrated by love. The clerk listened and smiled, with the air of one accustomed to store in his memory all intelligent conversation that he hears, in order to make use of it afterwards. But what is this love that consecrates marriage? Said, suddenly, the voice of the nervous and taciturn gentleman, who, unnoticed by us, had approached. He was standing with his hand on the seat, and evidently agitated. His face was red, a vein in his forehead was swollen, and the muscles of his cheeks quivered. What is this love that consecrates marriage? He repeated. What love? Said the lady. The ordinary love of husband and wife. And how, then, can ordinary love consecrate marriage? Continued the nervous gentleman, still excited, and with a displeased air. He seemed to wish to say something disagreeable to the lady. She felt it, and began to grow agitated. How? Why, very simply, said she. The nervous gentleman seized the word as it left her lips. No, not simply. Madam says, interceded the lawyer indicating his companion, that marriage should be first the result of an attachment, of a love, if you will, and that, when love exists, and in that case only, marriage represents something sacred. But every marriage which is not based on a natural attachment, on love, has in it nothing that is morally obligatory. Is not that the idea that you intended to convey? He asked the lady. The lady, with a nod of her head, expressed her approval of this translation of her thoughts. Then, resumed the lawyer, continuing his remarks. But the nervous gentleman, evidently scarcely able to contain himself, without allowing the lawyer to finish, asked. Yes, sir. But what are we to understand by this love that alone consecrates marriage? Everybody knows what love is, said the lady. But I don't know, and I should like to know how you define it. How? It is very simple, said the lady. And she seemed thoughtful, and then said. Love is a preference for one man or one woman to the exclusion of all others. A preference for how long? For a month, 2 days, or half an hour? Said the nervous gentleman, with special irritation. No, permit me, you evidently are not talking of the same thing. Yes, I am talking absolutely of the same thing. Of the preference for one man or one woman to the exclusion of all others. But I ask, a preference for how long? For how long? For a long time, for a lifetime sometimes. But that happens only in novels. In life, never. In life this preference for one to the exclusion of all others lasts in rare cases several years, oftener several months, or even weeks, days, hours. Oh, sir. Oh, no, no, permit me, said all three of us at the same time. The clerk himself uttered a monosyllable of disapproval. Yes, I know, he said, shouting louder than all of us, you are talking of what is believed to exist, and I am talking of what is. Every man feels what you call love toward each pretty woman he sees, and very little toward his wife. That is the origin of the proverb, and it is a true one, another's wife is a white swan, and ours is bitter wormwood. Ah, but what you say is terrible. There certainly exists among human beings this feeling which is called love, and which lasts, not for months and years, but for life. No, that does not exist. Even if it should be admitted that Menelaus had preferred Helen all his life, Helen would have preferred Paris, and so it has been, is, and will be eternally. And it cannot be otherwise, just as it cannot happen that, in a load of chickpeas, two peas marked with a special sign should fall side by side. Further, this is not only an improbability, but it is certain that a feeling of satiety will come to Helen or to Menelaus. The whole difference is that to one it comes sooner, to the other later. It is only in stupid novels that it is written that they loved each other all their lives. And none but children can believe it. To talk of loving a man or woman for life is like saying that a candle can burn forever. But you are talking of physical love. Do you not admit a love based upon a conformity of ideals, on a spiritual affinity? Why not? But in that case it is not necessary to procreate together, excuse my brutality. The point is that this conformity of ideals is not met among old people, but among young and pretty persons, said he, and he began to laugh disagreeably. Yes, I affirm that love, real love, does not consecrate marriage, as we are in the habit of believing, but that, on the contrary, it ruins it. Permit me, said the lawyer. The facts contradict your words. We see that marriage exists, that all humanity at least a larger portion lives conjugally, and that many husbands and wives honestly end a long life together. The nervous gentleman smiled ill-naturedly. And what then? You say that marriage is based upon love, and when I give voice to a doubt as to the existence of any other love than sensual love, you prove to me the existence of love by marriage. But in our day marriage is only a violence and falsehood. No, pardon me, said the lawyer. I say only that marriages have existed and do exist. But how and why do they exist? They have existed, and they do exist, for people who have seen, and do see, in marriage something sacramental, a sacrament that is binding before God. For such people marriages exist, but to us they are only hypocrisy and violence. We feel it, and, to clear ourselves, we preach free love, but, really, to preach free love is only a call backward to the promiscuity of the sexes. Excuse me, he said to the lady, the haphazard sin of certain rascaniks. The old foundation is shattered, we must build a new one, but we must not preach debauchery. He grew so warm that all became silent, looking at him in astonishment. And yet the transition state is terrible. People feel that haphazard sin is inadmissible. It is necessary in some way or other to regulate the sexual relations, but there exists no other foundation than the old one, in which nobody longer believes. People marry in the old fashion, without believing in what they do, and the result is falsehood, violence. When it is falsehood alone, it is easily endured. The husband and wife simply deceive the world by professing to live monogamically. If they really are polygamous and polyandrous, it is bad, but acceptable. But when, as often happens, the husband and the wife have taken upon themselves the obligation to live together all their lives, they themselves do not know why, and from the second month have already a desire to separate, but continue to live together just the same, then comes that infernal existence in which they resort to drink, in which they fire revolvers, in which they assassinate each other, in which they poison each other. All were silent, but we felt ill at ease. Yes, these critical episodes happen in marital life. For instance, there is the Posnichev affair, said the lawyer, wishing to stop the conversation on this embarrassing and too exciting ground. Have you read how he killed his wife through jealousy? The lady said that she had not read it. The nervous gentleman said nothing, and changed color. I see that you have divined who I am, said he, suddenly, after a pause. No, I have not had that pleasure. It is no great pleasure. I am Posnichev. New silence. He blushed, then turned pale again. What matters it, however? Said he. Excuse me, I do not wish to embarrass you. And he resumed his old seat. Chapter 3. I resumed mine, also. The lawyer and the lady whispered together. I was sitting beside Posnichev, and I maintained silence. I desired to talk to him, but I did not know how to begin, and thus an hour passed until we reached the next station. There the lawyer and the lady went out, as well as the clerk. We were left alone, Posnichev and I. They say it, and they lie, or they do not understand, said Posnichev. Of what are you talking? Why, still the same thing. He leaned his elbows upon his knees, and pressed his hands against his temples. Love, marriage, family, All lies, lies, lies. He rose, lowered the lampshade, lay down with his elbows on the cushion, and closed his eyes. He remained thus for a minute. Is it disagreeable to you to remain with me, now that you know who I am?
Oh, no.
You have no desire to sleep?
Not at all.
Then do you want me to tell you the story of my life?
Just then the conductor passed. He followed him with an ill-natured look, and did not begin until he had gone again. Then during all the rest of the story he did not stop once. Even the new travelers as they entered did not stop him. His face, while he was talking, changed several times so completely that it bore positively no resemblance to itself as it had appeared just before. His eyes, his mouth, his mustache, and even his beard, all were new. Each time it was a beautiful and touching physiognomy, and these transformations were produced suddenly in the penumbra, and for 5 minutes it was the same face, that could not be compared to that of 5 minutes before. And then, I know not how, it changed again, and became unrecognizable.
Chapter 4. Well, I am going then to tell you my life, and my whole frightful history,
yes, frightful.
And the story itself is more frightful than the outcome. He became silent for a moment, passed his hands over his eyes, and began, dash. To be understood clearly, the whole must be told from the beginning. It must be told how and why I married, and what I was before my marriage. First, I will tell you who I am. The son of a rich gentleman of the steppes, an old marshal of the nobility, I was a university pupil, a graduate of the law school. I married in my 30th year. But before talking to you of my marriage, I must tell you how I lived formerly, and what ideas I had of conjugal life. I led the life of so many other so-called respectable people, that is, in debauchery. And like the majority, while leading the life of a debauch, I was convinced that I was a man of irreproachable morality. The idea that I had of my morality arose from the fact that in my family there was no knowledge of those special debaucheries, so common in the surroundings of landowners, and also from the fact that my father and my mother did not deceive each other. In consequence of this, I had built from childhood a dream of high and poetical conjugal life. My wife was to be perfection itself, our mutual love was to be incomparable, the purity of our conjugal life stainless. I thought thus, and all the time I marveled at the nobility of my projects. At the same time, I passed 10 years of my adult life without hurrying toward marriage, and I led what I called the well-regulated and reasonable life of a bachelor. I was proud of it before my friends, and before all men of my age who abandoned themselves to all sorts of special refinements. I was not a seducer, I had no unnatural tastes, I did not make debauchery the principal object of my life, but I found pleasure within the limits of society's rules, and innocently believed myself a profoundly moral being. The women with whom I had relations did not belong to me alone, and I asked of them nothing but the pleasure of the moment. In all this I saw nothing abnormal. On the contrary, from the fact that I did not engage my heart, but paid in cash, I supposed that I was honest. I avoided those women who, by attaching themselves to me, or presenting me with a child, could bind my future. Moreover, perhaps there may have been children or attachments, but I so arranged matters that I could not become aware of them. And living thus, I considered myself a perfectly honest man. I did not understand that debauchery does not consist simply in physical acts, that no matter what physical ignominy does not yet constitute debauchery, and that real debauchery consists in freedom from the moral bonds toward a woman with whom one enters into carnal relations, and I regarded this freedom as a merit. I remember that I once tortured myself exceedingly for having forgotten to pay a woman who probably had given herself to me through love. I only became tranquil again when, having sent her the money, I had thus shown her that I did not consider myself as in any way bound to her. Oh, do not shake your head as if you were in agreement with me, he cried suddenly with vehemence. I know these tricks. All of you, and you especially, if you are not a rare exception, have the same ideas that I had then. If you are in agreement with me, it is now only. Formerly you did not think so. No more did I, and, if I had been told what I have just told you, that which has happened would not have happened. However, it is all the same. Excuse me, he continued, the truth is that it is frightful, 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 this abyss of errors and debaucheries in which we live face to face with the real question of the rights of woman. What do you mean by the real question of the rights of woman? The question of the nature of this special being, organized otherwise than man, and how this being and man ought to view the wife. Chapter 5. Yes, for 10 years I lived the most revolting existence, while dreaming of the noblest love, and even in the name of that love.
Yes, I want to tell you how I killed my wife, and for that I must tell you how I debauched myself. I killed her before I knew her. I killed the wife when I first tasted sensual joys without love, and then it was that I killed my wife. Yes, sir, it is only after having suffered, after having tortured myself, that I have come to understand the root of things, that I have come to understand my crimes. Thus you will see where and how began the drama that has led me to misfortune. It is necessary to go back to my 16th year, when I was still at school, and my elder brother a first-year student. I had not yet known women but, like all the unfortunate children of our society, I was already no longer innocent. I was tortured, as you were, I am sure, and as are tortured 99/100 of our boys. I lived in a frightful dread, I prayed to God, and I prostrated myself. I was already perverted in imagination, but the last steps remained to be taken. I could still escape, when a friend of my brother, a very gay student, one of those who are called good fellows, that is, the greatest of scamps, and who had taught us to drink and play cards, took advantage of a night of intoxication to drag us there. We started. My brother, as innocent as I, fell that night, and I, a mere lad of 16, polluted myself and helped to pollute a sister woman, without understanding what I did. Never had I heard from my elders that what I thus did was bad. It is true that there are the 10 commandments of the Bible, but the commandments are made only to be recited before the priests at examinations, and even then are not as exacting as the commandments in regard to the use of and conditional propositions. Thus, from my elders, whose opinion I esteemed, I had never heard that this was reprehensible. On the contrary, I had heard people whom I respected say that it was good. I had heard that my struggles and my sufferings would be appeased after this act. I had heard it and read it. I had heard from my elders that it was excellent for the health, and my friends have always seemed to believe that it contained I know not what merit and valor. So nothing is seen in it but what is praiseworthy. As for the danger of disease, it is a foreseen danger. Does not the government guard against it? And even science corrupts us. How so, science? I asked. Why, the doctors, the pontiffs of science. Who pervert young people by laying down such rules of hygiene? Who pervert women by devising and teaching them ways by which not to have children? Yes, if only 1/100th of the effort spent in curing diseases were spent in curing debauchery, disease would long ago have ceased to exist, whereas now all efforts are employed, not in extirpating debauchery, but in favoring it, by assuring the harmlessness of the consequences. Besides, it is not a question of that. It is a question of this frightful thing that has happened to me, as it happens to 9/10, if not more, not only of the men of our society, but of all societies, even peasants, this frightful thing that I had fallen, and not because I was subjected to the natural seduction of a certain woman. No, no woman seduced me. I fell because the surroundings in which I found myself saw in this degrading thing only a legitimate function, useful to the health, because others saw in it simply a natural amusement, not only excusable, but even innocent in a young man. I did not understand that it was a fall, and I began to give myself to those pleasures, partly from desire and partly from necessity, which I was led to believe were characteristic of my age, just as I had begun to drink and smoke. And yet there was in this first fall something peculiar and touching. I remember that straightway I was filled with such a profound sadness that I had a desire to weep over the loss forever of my relations with woman. Yes, my relations with woman were lost forever. Pure relations with women, from that time forward, I could no longer have. I had become what is called a voluptuary, and to be a voluptuary is a physical condition like the condition of a victim of the morphine habit, of a drunkard, and of a smoker. Just as the victim of the morphine habit, the drunkard, the smoker, is no longer a normal man, so the man who has known several women for his pleasure is no longer normal? He is abnormal forever. He is a voluptuary. Just as the drunkard and the victim of the morphine habit may be recognized by their face and manner, so we may recognize a voluptuary. He may repress himself and struggle, but nevermore will he enjoy sinful, pure, and fraternal relations toward woman. By his way of glancing at a young woman one may at once recognize a voluptuary, and I became a voluptuary, and I have remained one. Chapter 6. Yes, so it is, and that went farther and farther with all sorts of variations. My God! When I remember all my cowardly acts and bad deeds, I am frightened. And I remember that me who, during that period, was still the butt of his comrades' ridicule on account of his innocence. And when I hear people talk of the gilded youth, of the officers, of the Parisians, and all these gentlemen, and myself, living wild lives at the age of 30, and who have on our consciences hundreds of crimes toward women, terrible and varied. When we enter a parlor or a ballroom, washed, shaven, and perfumed, with very white linen, in dress coats or in uniform, as emblems of purity, oh, the disgust. There will surely come a time, an epoch, when all these lies and all this cowardice will be unveiled. So, nevertheless, I lived, until the age of 30, without abandoning for a minute my intention of marrying, and building an elevated conjugal life, and with this in view I watched all young girls who might suit me. I was buried in rottenness, and at the same time I looked for virgins, whose purity was worthy of me. Many of them were rejected, they did not seem to me pure enough. Finally I found one that I considered on a level with myself. She was one of two daughters of a landed proprietor of Pensa, formerly very rich and since ruined. To tell the truth, without false modesty, they pursued me and finally captured me. The mother, the father was away, laid all sorts of traps, and one of these, a trip in a boat, decided my future. I made up my mind at the end of the aforesaid trip one night, by moonlight, on our way home, while I was sitting beside her. I admired her slender body, whose charming shape was molded by a jersey, and her curling hair, and I suddenly concluded that this was she. It seemed to me on that beautiful evening that she understood all that I thought and felt, and I thought and felt the most elevating things. Really, it was only the jersey that was so becoming to her, and her curly hair, and also the fact that I had spent the day beside her, and that I desired a more intimate relation. I returned home enthusiastic, and I persuaded myself that she realized the highest perfection, and that for that reason she was worthy to be my wife, and the next day I made to her a proposal of marriage. No, say what you will, we live in such an abyss of falsehood, that, unless some event strikes us a blow on the head, as in my case, we cannot awaken. What confusion! Out of the thousands of men who marry, not only among us, but also among the people, scarcely will you find a single one who has not previously married at least 10 times. It is true that there now exist, at least so I have heard, pure young people who feel and know that this is not a joke, but a serious matter. May God come to their aid. But in my time there was not to be found one such in 1,000. And I'll know it, and pretend not to know it. In all the novels are described down to the smallest details the feelings of the characters, the lakes and brambles around which they walk, but, when it comes to describing their great love, not a word is breathed of what he, the interesting character, has previously done, not a word about his frequenting of disreputable houses, or his association with nursery maids, cooks, and the wives of others. And if anything is said of these things, such improper novels are not allowed in the hands of young girls. All men have the air of believing, in presence of maidens, that these corrupt pleasures, in which everybody takes part, do not exist, or exist only to a very small extent. They pretend it so carefully that they succeed in convincing themselves of it. As for the poor young girls, they believe it quite seriously, just as my poor wife believed it. I remember that, being already engaged, I showed her my memoirs, from which she could learn more or less of my past, and especially my last liaison, which she might perhaps have discovered through the gossip of some third party. It was for this last reason, for that matter, that I felt the necessity of communicating these memoirs to her. I can still see her fright, her despair, her bewilderment, when she had learned and understood it. She was on the point of breaking the engagement. What a lucky thing it would have been for both of us. Poznichev was silent for a moment, and then resumed, dash. After all, no. It is better that things happened as they did, better. He cried. It was a good thing for me. Besides, it makes no difference. I was saying that in these cases it is the poor young girls who are deceived. As for the mothers especially, informed by their husbands, they know all, and, while pretending to believe in the purity of the young man, they act as if they did not believe in it. They know what bait must be held out to people for themselves and their daughters. We men sin through ignorance, and a determination not to learn. As for the women, they know very well that the noblest and most poetic love, as we call it, depends, not on moral qualities, but on the physical intimacy, and also on the manner of doing the hair, and the color and shape. Ask an experienced coquette, who has undertaken to seduce a man, which he would prefer, to be convicted, in presence of the man whom she is engaged in conquering, of falsehood, perversity, cruelty, or to appear before him in an ill-fitting dress, or a dress of an unbecoming color. She will prefer the first alternative. She knows very well that we simply lie when we talk of our elevated sentiments, that we seek only the possession of her body, and that because of that we will forgive her every sort of baseness, but will not forgive her a costume of an ugly shade, without taste or fit. And these things she knows by reason, whereas the maiden knows them only by instinct, like the animal. Hence these abominable jerseys, these artificial humps on the back, these bare shoulders, arms, and throats. Women, especially those who have passed through the school of marriage, know very well that conversations upon elevated subjects are only conversations, and that man seeks and desires the body and all that ornaments the body. Consequently, they act accordingly. If we reject conventional explanations, and view the life of our upper and lower classes as it is, with all its shamelessness, it is only a vast perversity. You do not share this opinion? Permit me, I am going to prove it to you, said he, interrupting me. You say that the women of our society live for a different interest from that which actuates fallen women. And I say no, and I am going to prove it to you. If beings differ from one another according to the purpose of their life, according to their inner life, this will necessarily be reflected also in their outer life, and their exterior will be very different. Well, then, compare the wretched, the despised, with the women of the highest society, the same dresses, the same fashions, the same perfumeries, the same passion for jewelry, for brilliant and very expensive articles, the same amusements, dances, music, and songs. The former attract by all possible means, so do the latter. No difference, none whatever. Yes, and I, too, was captivated by jerseys, bustles, and curly hair. Chapter 7. And it was very easy to capture me, since I was brought up under artificial conditions, like cucumbers in a hothouse. Our too abundant nourishment, together with complete physical idleness, is nothing but systematic excitement of the imagination. The men of our society are fed and kept like reproductive stallions. It is sufficient to close the valve, that is, for a young man to live a quiet life for some time, to produce as an immediate result a restlessness, which, becoming exaggerated by reflection through the prism of our unnatural life, provokes the illusion of love. All our idols in marriage, all, are the result for the most part of our eating. Does that astonish you? For my part, I am astonished that we do not see it. Not far from my estate this spring some mujiks were working on a railway embankment. You know what a peasant's food is, bread, kvass, onions. With this frugal nourishment he lives, he is alert, he makes light work in the fields. But on the railway this bill of fare becomes kacha and a pound of meat. Only he restores this meat by 16 hours of labor pushing loads weighing 1200 pounds. And we, who eat 2 pounds of meat and game, we who absorb all sorts of heating drinks and food, how do we expend it? In sensual excesses. If the valve is open, all goes well, but close it, as I had closed it temporarily before my marriage, and immediately there will result an excitement which, deformed by novels, verses, music, by our idle and luxurious life, will give a love of the finest water. I, too, fell in love, as everybody does, and there were transports, emotions, poesy, but really all this passion was prepared by Mama and the dressmakers. If there had been no trips in boats, no well-fitted garments, etc., if my wife had worn some shapeless blouse, and I had seen her thus at her home, I should not have been seduced. Chapter 8. And note, also, this falsehood, of which all are guilty, the way in which marriages are made. What could there be more natural? The young girl is marriageable, she should marry. What simpler, provided the young person is not a monster, and men can be found with a desire to marry. Well, no, here begins a new hypocrisy. Formerly, when the maiden arrived at a favorable age, her marriage was arranged by her parents. That was done, that is done still, throughout humanity, among the Chinese, the Hindus, the Muslims, and among our common people also. Things are so managed in at least 99% of the families of the entire human race. Only we riotous livers have imagined that this way was bad, and have invented another. And this other, what is it? It is this. The young girls are seated, and the gentlemen walk up and down before them, as in a bazaar, and make their choice. The maidens wait and think, but do not dare to say, take me, young man, me and not her. Look at these shoulders and the rest. We males walk up and down, and estimate the merchandise, and then we discourse upon the rights of woman, upon the liberty that she acquires, I know not how, in the theatrical halls. But what is to be done? Said I to him. Shall the woman make the advances? I do not know. But, if it is a question of equality, let the equality be complete. Though it has been found that to contract marriages through the agency of matchmakers is humiliating, it is nevertheless 1,000 times preferable to our system. There the rights and the chances are equal, here the woman is a slave, exhibited in the market. But as she cannot bend to her condition, or make advances herself, there begins that other and more abominable lie which is sometimes called going into society, sometimes amusing oneself, and which is really nothing but the hunt for a husband. But say to a mother or to her daughter that they are engaged only in a hunt for a husband. God! What an offense! Yet they can do nothing else, and have nothing else to do, and the terrible feature of it all is to see sometimes very young, poor, and innocent maidens haunted solely by such ideas. If only, I repeat, it were done frankly, but it is always accompanied with lies and babble of this sort, dash. Ah, the descent of species. How interesting it is. Oh, Lily is much interested in painting. Shall you go to the exposition? How charming it is. And the troika, and the plays, and the symphony. Ah, how adorable. My Lisa is passionately fond of music. And you, why do you not share these convictions? And through all this verbiage, all have but one single idea, take me, take my Lisa. No, me. Only try. Chapter 9. Do you know, suddenly continued Poznichev, that this power of women from which the world suffers arises solely from what I have just spoken of? What do you mean by the power of women? I said. Everybody, on the contrary, complains that women have not sufficient rights, that they are in subjection. That's it exactly, said he, vivaciously. That is just what I mean, and that is the explanation of this extraordinary phenomenon, that on the one hand woman is reduced to the lowest degree of humiliation and on the other hand she reigns over everything. See the Jews, with their power of money, they avenge their subjection, just as the women do. Ah! You wish us to be only merchants? All right, remaining merchants, we will get possession of you, say the Jews. Ah! You wish us to be only objects of sensuality? All right, by the aid of sensuality we will bend you beneath our yoke, say the women. The absence of the rights of woman does not consist in the fact that she has not the right to vote, or the right to sit on the bench, but in the fact that in her affectional relations she is not the equal of man, she has not the right to abstain, to choose instead of being chosen. You say that that would be abnormal. Very well. But then do not let man enjoy these rights, while his companion is deprived of them, and finds herself obliged to make use of the coquetry by which he governs, so that the result is that man chooses formally, whereas really it is woman who chooses. As soon as she is in possession of her means, she abuses them, and acquires a terrible supremacy. But where do you see this exceptional power? Where? Why, everywhere, in everything. Go see the stores in the large cities. There are millions there, millions. It is impossible to estimate the enormous quantity of labor that is expended there. In 9/10 of these stores is there anything whatever for the use of men? All the luxury of life is demanded and sustained by women. Count the factories, the greater part of them are engaged in making feminine ornaments. Millions of men, generations of slaves, die toiling like convicts simply to satisfy the whims of our companions. Women, like queens, keep 9/10 of the human race as prisoners of war, or as prisoners at hard labor. And all this because they have been humiliated, because they have been deprived of rights equal to those which men enjoy. They take revenge for our sensuality, they catch us in their nets. Yes, the whole thing is there. Women have made of themselves such a weapon to act upon the senses that a young man, and even an old man, cannot remain tranquil in their presence. Watch a popular festival, or our receptions or ballrooms. Woman well knows her influence there. You will see it in her triumphant smiles. As soon as a young man advances toward a woman, directly he falls under the influence of this opium, and loses his head. Long ago I felt ill at ease when I saw a woman too well adorned, whether a woman of the people with her red neckerchief and her looped skirt, or a woman of our own society in her ballroom dress. But now it simply terrifies me. I see in it a danger to men, something contrary to the laws, and I feel a desire to call a policeman, to appeal for defense from some quarter, to demand that this dangerous object be removed. And this is not a joke, by any means. I am convinced, I am sure, that the time will come and perhaps it is not far distant when the world will understand this, and will be astonished that a society could exist in which actions as harmful as those which appeal to sensuality by adorning the body as our companions do were allowed. As well set traps along our public streets, or worse than that. Chapter 10. That, then, was the way in which I was captured. I was in love, as it is called. Not only did she appear to me a perfect being, but I considered myself a white blackbird. It is a commonplace fact that there is no one so low in the world that he cannot find someone viler than himself, and consequently puff with pride and self-contentment. I was in that situation. I did not marry for money. Interest was foreign to the affair, unlike the marriages of most of my acquaintances, who married either for money or for relations. First, I was rich, she was poor. Second, I was especially proud of the fact that, while others married with an intention of continuing their polygamic life as bachelors, it was my firm intention to live monogamically after my engagement and the wedding, and my pride swelled immeasurably. Yes, I was a wretch, convinced that I was an angel. The period of my engagement did not last long. I cannot remember those days without shame. What an abomination. It is generally agreed that love is a moral sentiment, a community of thought rather than of sense. If that is the case, this community of thought ought to find expression in words and conversation. Nothing of the sort. It was extremely difficult for us to talk with each other. What a toil of Sisyphus was our conversation. Scarcely had we thought of something to say, and said it, when we had to resume our silence and try to discover new subjects. Literally, we did not know what to say to each other. All that we could think of concerning the life that was before us in our home was said. And then what? If we had been animals, we should have known that we had not to talk. But here, on the contrary, it was necessary to talk, and there were no resources. For that which occupied our minds was not a thing to be expressed in words. And then that silly custom of eating bonbons, that brutal gluttony for sweetmeats, those abominable preparations for the wedding, those discussions with Mama upon the apartments, upon the sleeping rooms, upon the bedding, upon the morning gowns, upon the wrappers, the linen, the costumes. Understand that if people married according to the old fashion, as this old man said just now, then these eiderdown coverlets and this bedding would all be sacred details, but with us, out of 10 married people there is scarcely to be found one who, I do not say believes in sacraments, whether he believes or not is a matter of indifference to us, but believes in what he promises. Out of 100 men, there is scarcely one who has not married before, and out of 50 scarcely one who has not made up his mind to deceive his wife. The great majority look upon this journey to the church as a condition necessary to the possession of a certain woman. Think then of the supreme significance which material details must take on. Is it not a sort of sale, in which a maiden is given over to a debauch, the sale being surrounded with the most agreeable details? 1 Chapter 11. All marry in this way. And I delight the rest. If the young people who dream of the honeymoon only knew what a disillusion it is, and always a disillusion. I really do not know why I'll think it necessary to conceal it. One day I was walking among the shows in Paris, when, attracted by a sign, I entered an establishment to see a bearded woman and a water dog. The woman was a man in disguise, and the dog was an ordinary dog, covered with a sealskin, and swimming in a bath. It was not in the least interesting, but the Barnum accompanied me to the exit very courteously, and, in addressing the people who were coming in, made an appeal to my testimony. Ask the gentleman if it is not worth seeing. Come in, come in. It only costs a franc. And in my confusion I did not dare to answer that there was nothing curious to be seen, and it was upon my false shame that the Barnum must have counted. It must be the same with the persons who have passed through the abominations of the honeymoon. They do not dare to undeceive their neighbor. And I did the same. The felicities of the honeymoon do not exist. On the contrary, it is a period of uneasiness, of shame, of pity, and, above all, of ennui, of ferocious ennui. It is something like the feeling of a youth when he is beginning to smoke. He desires to vomit, he drivels, and swallows his drivel, pretending to enjoy this little amusement. The vice of marriage. What? Vice? I said. But you are talking of one of the most natural things. Natural? Said he. Natural? No, I consider on the contrary that it is against nature, and it is I, a perverted man, who have reached this conviction. What would it be, then, if I had not known corruption? To a young girl, to every unperverted young girl, it is an act extremely unnatural, just as it is to children. My sister married, when very young, a man twice her own age, and who was utterly corrupt. I remember how astonished we were the night of her wedding, when, pale and covered with tears, she fled from her husband, her whole body trembling, saying that for nothing in the world would she tell what he wanted of her. You say natural? It is natural to eat, that is a pleasant, agreeable function, which no one is ashamed to perform.